This is the SF Signal Podcast. I'm your host. My name is Patrick Hester. And because I'm your host, I can pretty much do whatever I want. And what I really, really wanted to do was torture James. Haven't done that in like a month. Felt like the right time to do it. And if you don't know James Gates is, she's like a publicist. She does some stuff for CIFWA. And of course,
don't go there.
She was the anthology editor for one of the most impactful anthologies that ever came out. It moved people. It moved them to tears. And of course, I'm talking about War Stories. I don't know why she's giggling. If you haven't read it yet, that's because you're just not me.
Wow, you've learned some sense of self-preservation in the last month. We'll see how long that lasts.
What did you think I was going to talk about?
War Stories, of course. Yeah. What else? Yes, I do a lot of work for a lot of different things, as you know, can be judged by the calendars that I spent the last hour building up for the next 2 years. Mostly, I am the communications director for the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, an editor and an author. And that mostly means that I have a lot of blackmail on people like Patrick, and no blackmail whatsoever on our other attendees.
Now, hold on. There's a reason you and I haven't been to the same convention in a long time, and that's because of your training from the Mossad. Because
I told you not to talk about that in public.
Exactly. What I'm curious about is I've heard the rumor that to this day, if you walk up to Scalzi and you say James Gates, he flinches.
There's actually photographic evidence of him telling me what a horrible publicist I am.
Oh, boy. So we're finally going to talk about social science fiction. And I say that because we got wires crossed a while ago, and I totally thought we were going to talk about social science fiction, and then we didn't talk about social science fiction. Mm-hmm. So you have gathered a bunch of people, which is the best part of this because it means I don't have to do squat, and to talk about social science fiction. So why don't you tell people how you're defining it, what it is, and what we're going to talk about tonight.
All right. And as soon as I do that, we'll start introducing people.
Yes, I'm going to make them wait. They can wait.
All right. So social science fiction is essentially the works of people like Le Guin, Bradbury, Huxley, Lieber. When I try to define this, I usually point out Fahrenheit 451 as the definitive example, where it is commenting specifically on a potential future and the risks if we continue in the way that we are going, or if we do not take certain risks. So
Brave New World, 1984, yeah. That kind of stuff.
Yeah, all of that. Octavia Butler's commentary on People was a really good example of it as well. And we've been seeing a lot more of it coming up recently. A really good modern example is Cory Doctorow and Little Brother and his other works there. So that's the kind of thing that we want to talk about today. Science fiction's impact on cultural and social trends and developments, and where that can go, both good and bad.
And to your credit, once again, you have gathered just an incredibly diverse group of people to talk about this.
Yes. The one unfortunate thing is that every single woman I invited had something else to do today. So I don't know what.
That's just insane, James. That has never happened to me before. That does not happen to me every single week that I do this crap. Not once. And what's funny is all the people who are going to absolutely complain about it and think that it's totally on purpose.
So, yeah, I actually invited significantly fewer men, but they are the ones who stepped bravely into the breach and decided that they would put themselves at my mercy for an hour, and they all deserve medals for this. So,
you know my theory on that.
White man's burden.
No, guys, I think guys are less responsible. So if you have a group of people and it's 50% women and 50% men, and you say, hey, I'd like you to be on the podcast, the 50% women go, I got way better things to do than that. And the 50% guys go, yeah, I can blow off whatever I'm doing. Sign me up.
I'm fairly sure you just insulted all of our attendees.
No, I'm not.
We have incredibly thick skins.
We volunteered to spend an hour on a podcast with James.
I know, right? I'm sure that there will never be scotch in your future ever again, Jeremy.
So do you want to go down the list and say hello to everybody, James, and let them introduce themselves?
Yeah, we'll have everyone introduce themselves, and we'll start with Jack, since he's the first on my screen.
Hi, I'm Jack Graham, and I'm one of a group of white dudes who are here to talk about social issues.
And what do you do, Jack?
I'm a game designer on the Eclipse Phase role-playing game, which is a post-apocalyptic transhuman sci-fi game that is deeply informed by left-wing politics and therefore grapples with a lot of the economic issues that are coming at us in the future from changing economies, changing political structures, that sort of thing. I'm responsible for a lot of the fiction output that goes along with the game line, and I've published a few sci-fi stories elsewhere. And since you said we should go ahead and plug our web and
yes.
social presences, we're at eclipsephase.com or on Twitter at just eclipsephase, all one word. And my personal blog is lonesomerobot.com.
Very cool. Who's next?
Happy to be here.
Good.
Jeremy.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Bernstein at Fajitas on Twitter. I'm a screenwriter and game designer. I'm a little bit of an outlier in that I haven't written a lot in the way of social science fiction. What I have written for a couple of years was the television series Leverage, which someone here apparently didn't know and enjoyed or hated. We'll find out later. But Leverage, for anyone not familiar with the show, is a modern day
shot.
Enjoyed, then, clearly. It's a modern-day Robin Hood show. It ran on TNT for 5 years. It's about a gang of thieves who rip off malfeasant corporations, and basically the process of working on that show was finding corporate shenanigans that had been going on in the news and then getting our characters to con and or rob them into oblivion. It was deeply cathartic, and almost every episode we did, I think there were 77 episodes of the show, and almost every single one of them was based on a real crime, a real perpetrator, something that a corporation had actually done. My other area of social involvement has been in the area of serious games, where I've worked on games that aren't just designed to entertain, but also to provide a political or moral or a philosophical message. I worked on the redistricting game, which was basically gerrymander the game. And if anyone is curious about why gerrymandering happens, you should take a look at redistrictinggame.org, and you'll see how appallingly easy it is.
So do Elliot and Parker and Hardison live happily ever after?
Sure. I'll go with yes. And so do Nate and Sophie, for that matter.
Yeah, but they left. They left it in the hands of the kids.
They did leave it in the hands of the kids and all of their friends, but I don't think those two are going to stay out of the game very long.
Hmm. We'll see.
Colin.
Colin Kelly. I'm the co-writer of Archaea Entertainment's Hacktivist, along with Jackson Lansing. We are screenwriters, by and large, and Hacktivist has been our first kind of book together, which really takes a look at kind of the cross-section between our modern digital climate and the Arab Spring. That's been my primary work. There's been a whole bunch of other stuff that we can't really talk about because nothing's really come to fruition. I really want to thank you guys for having us on. On Twitter, I am CP Kelly, and my website is thecolinkelly.com.
Two L's.
Two L's, yes, thank you.
Jackson?
I am Jackson Lansing. My Twitter account is at Jackson Lansing. That's like the capital of... Yes, that's like the capital of Michigan, except with a Z. It's a totally made-up name. It was Lansinger, and it got all, you know, un-Germanified around World War II. The truth is, yeah, Colin and I have been writing screenplays for about 5 years together, and we've written actually a fair amount of science fiction, but as is often the case in Hollywood, we've signed so many NDAs on so many projects that it's rare that we actually get to talk about one. And since none of them have made it to theaters yet, that makes it slightly hard for us to talk about our work. Fortunately, we have Hacktivist out now, which is, as Colin described, kind of a we were talking about Cory Doctorow earlier. I'd say we're very well in line with the kind of work that Mr. Doctorow is doing, and we're obviously huge fans of Little Brother. And that was a huge influence on us moving forward in that book. I've also written another piece of, I think, what could probably be classified to some degree of social science fiction, though far less than Hacktivist directly, a book I wrote called Freak Show with Ape Entertainment alongside David Server and Joe Suter, which was something of a comment on refugee stories and on the amount to which we look at refugees as victims and how we can start looking at them as their own people and as heroes and as fighters in their own right, rather than things to be saved, people who can to some degree save themselves, which you'll find is kind of a theme in our work. Those who've read Hacktivist are already starting to get that probably just from the words I'm saying. So that's really where I live. I also spend some time in film marketing and in, you know, production, and I'm all over the place. But I spend a good deal of my time reading and thinking and absorbing on a lot of these topics.
It's interesting that you mentioned the NDAs, because I know a friend of mine is an animator and for a very long time worked for DreamWorks and could never ever talk about any movie he was working on.
Oh yeah, no, it's actually incredibly troublesome as a writer, because you'll say, oh, well, I'm a writer. And you are a professional writer. You are being paid to write. You have lots of script. I mean, Colin and I have, I think, no less than 8 features under our belt, for directors that you've heard of and producers that you've heard of and studios that you see movies for from all the time. And not a single one is one that we could put on your hand, you know, put on your podcast or put in your hands and say, this is what we did, which can be extra troublesome. But we've been incredibly fortunate, I think, to find ourselves in comics recently where that's not the case.
Cool.
And Dave?
Oh, yeah. I am actually on this podcast and not just listening to it. I was quite enjoying it as if I'd already downloaded it. My name is Dave Moss. I wear a lot of different hats at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. If you're not familiar with our organization, we are a nonprofit based in San Francisco that defends civil liberties in the digital world. So that's, you know, basically internet freedom, if we're only going to reduce it down to 2 words.
Net neutrality.
That is one of the things we work on. We work on net neutrality. We have 3 lawsuits against the NSA at the moment.
Good for you.
We sue the government to find out what kind of surveillance equipment they're using. And, you know, we do a lot of things related to patent reform, defending podcasters who've come under the hammer of patent trolls. And we also work on copyright reform, fair use, train activists around the world on how to use anti-circumvention tools and avoid government malware, whole range of things. But my role here is, you know, I do a little bit of media relations. I do some investigative research. I'm also the unofficial geek liaison at EFF, where I go to fan conventions and I preach the good word. I recently just came back from Dragon Con, where we had coordinated a cosplay photo activism campaign called Project Secret Identity, which is at projectsecretidentity.org, where the idea was to get cosplayers to stand up for the right to anonymity and privacy by using the characters that they inhabit through the convention. I'm also putting together an anthology of science fiction stories dealing with our issues that we'll be putting out sometime late next year.
It's interesting that you mentioned the podcasting, the podcasters and the, I blanked on the word, array trademark or patent infringements, because didn't they just went after Adam Carolla?
They did. He actually settled. They've been going after him for a while. He settled. They've also gone after Mark Maron. There's a few other people they've gone after. You know, the concept is they send you a letter saying they're going to sue you unless you pony up some money. And you look, you know, as a podcaster, you sit there and you say, well, $1,000 to buy their license or go to court and do what's right and then possibly bankrupt myself in the process. It's a hard calculation for a lot of people. And so people like Adam Carolla and Mark Maron have some resources in which to step up. They've also sued some of the major TV broadcasting companies. I could go on about this forever, but
I just throw it out there because one of the things that I, you know, I teach people about podcasting at these conventions that I go to, and you know, people say, well, how do I make money at podcasting? And then when I'm done laughing, That's pretty much as far as I go. Yeah.
Dave, actually, we were on our way to Baltimore. I have a delightful anti-NSA sticker that you gave me that I keep on my laptop. And as we were going through security, I had a TSA agent stop me and kind of look over his glasses at me, and he says, "Son, is this your computer?" Kind of tapping the sticker, and I thought to myself, the TSA and NSA are kissing cousins. They are going to cause some stink for me." And he kind of glared at me, looked at me, and said, "I agree."
Not long. Oh, that's funny.
He has since disappeared.
That was that guy's last day at LAX.
So, Jane, TSA.
Yes. So I want to start off with talking about the perception of science fiction as it kind of has two perceptions in traditional history. The cheesy, scantily clad woman on the cover with a rocket ship, or, you know, again, going back to things like 1984, people taking a hard look at the future and trying to make it a better place, or say, hey, we're doing this thing that may lead to this possible outcome and we don't like that. So I want to talk briefly about some of the founding works of that and, you know, the results that we're seeing from it today, especially looking at Bradbury, some of his warning stories, and, you know, the stuff that we're starting to see with the internet and surveillance states, things like that. So I'll let Patrick pick the first victim, but basically the question is, who of the early writers wrote stuff that we're starting to see come true today? And who wrote stuff that we could possibly be seeing come true in the near future?
We're going to start with Jackson.
Oh, why, thanks, guys. I appreciate it. So it's funny because, I think everybody, when they start to talk about social science fiction, almost immediately starts talking about Fahrenheit 451. And I think it's a fairly – I think in a lot of ways that's because it doesn't really muddy the it doesn't muddy the waters with any other kind of science fiction. I'd say most of my introduction to social sci-fi is a little bit later on and probably has a lot more overlap with things like cyberpunk. I would look at a lot of the works that William Gibson ran throughout most of my sort of adolescent youth the period at which I was growing up, and look at that and say, okay, well, that was really my formative years for social sci-fi. But when I go back to Fahrenheit 451, I think there's something that it really teaches us, and something that is very apparent, you know, around us today, which is that as the internet has expanded our ability to log stories, to keep stories, to keep information, and to make it free, Fahrenheit 451 reminds us that the government will continue, and control systems will continue to sort of stagger their control in a similar way. So now we see, and this is something obviously the EFF deals with a lot, David, is we will start to see them pace out their ability to control information and their ability to control the truth alongside our ability to report it and understand it. So you look at something like the 24-hour news cycle and the amount of corporate control that's amounted there. You look at the ability for us to keep uncensored materials, in libraries around the country, which is still a really threatened resource. Well, and then you look
Did you hear about the kid who was running the banned book library out of his locker?
I did. All you have to do is look at how freaked authorities got about the very idea of an independent library and a banned book library, which is one of the most unthreatening things in the world.
Right.
One of the things that we really tried to deal with in Hacktivist, and so we're fairly passionate about, is this idea of internet freedom, not just in Western countries. And I think we can tend to look at our world from a very American-centric point of view, because that's where we live and that's where we see, the world. But ultimately, internet access is not as egalitarian everywhere else as it is here. It is not as much of a basic right. And frankly, even in America, though it may seem like internet access is very common and very much a basic right, it still isn't. And there are still great deals of the population that don't have everyday regular internet access outside of places like libraries, which are now being threatened. And they are being threatened not because people aren't going to libraries, though that is absolutely part of the case, and the internet is doing that to libraries, but also because there's not a lot of control systems. Those people that actually have the money, and by control systems, I mean corporations, I mean governments, I mean organizations of people with money and means that actually have the, let's say, the incentive to keep these kind of places going. And as a result, you end up with what Fahrenheit 451 posits, which is a population that you can actually control in a really legitimate way. And that's not about controlling them the way that we think of dystopic control, boots on the ground, keeping you inside your house, distilling curfews, you know, any one of a number of things, you know, harsh sentences for minor crimes, which in themselves are big problems.
Police departments getting tanks.
Well, see, and there you go. Yeah, you, I mean, that is an entirely different sort of side of this thing, but is essentially, it all kind of ties up to this, which is that how many of us knew that those police departments had tanks until we all started seeing pictures of it from Ferguson?
Right.
Now, the Ferguson Police Department is not the only police department with tanks. Nope. That weekend, we were walking – I walked to a terribly run music festival here in Los Angeles, and out front of that terribly run music festival to respond to the occasional like violence that might pop up from this, you know, there being a bunch of drunken kids all kicking around a field in Los Angeles, there was an armored – LAPD tank vehicle. You know, and I had a bunch of, you know, there were a bunch of police standing around the thing. And it's not to say that they shouldn't have those materials for the right purposes. And by right purposes, I mean like literal like gang warfare in the streets of their cities, which Ferguson doesn't amount to.
And to be fair, LA had that in Die Hard. So
yes, absolutely. Look, we have to prepare for Escape from New York, but until we do that, I think we're looking at a world where we've actually, I think, slipped very firmly into a lot of what was predicted by Fahrenheit 451, but the internet has allowed us the ability to completely subvert it constantly, through the inability, at least right now, for people to effectively censor the internet. And the ability for anyone essentially to create new material on the internet, to disseminate it through any one of a number of fields, and you see how quickly both good and bad information spreads. You just saw this sort of horrifying iCloud leak that went down just last week. That, you know, bad information, good information, it can all disseminate very rapidly on the internet. And the minute that we start to say, okay, well, we're going to censor this or we're going to censor that, we're going to start going down the exact same path as we have with physical media. So my hope is that in a lot of ways, as we go into a lot of the future that was predicted by social sci-fi, and social sci-fi is there very much to predict what's coming down the pipe, and I think is probably very rarely wrong, unfortunately, in its basic points of view.
So
we're going to end up with something that, you know, we can actually subvert it against using the internet.
So here's my question to Dave. Dave, do you remember James' question?
It was a very long time ago.
I'm sorry.
I'm going to have to consult the NSA call record database to figure out what was being said.
Well, I have to wonder how many of the people will be disappearing after this podcast.
So go back to, you know, we just talked a lot about Fahrenheit 451. What other stories do you think, you know, kind of started this?
Well, you know, it's unfortunate because I feel like as we're talking about 1984 and Fahrenheit 451 and Brave New World and all this sort of stuff, these were stories that I encountered through an academic lens. These were assignments for class as opposed to something that I came across.
Which they typically are. I mean, that's just what it is.
Yeah, yeah. So, but for me, and if, you know, being, you know, in my mid-30s, what I perceive to be what first got me interested in this are, you know, the literature of the late 70s and the early 80s, you know, the Philip K. Dicks and things like that. But, you know, what comes to mind for me, particularly most recently, is, say, Terry Gilliam's Brazil. I actually, at Dragon Con, cosplayed as Harry Tuttle, who is this is one of the earliest films treating the big data computer run state, where the entire plot revolves around a clerical error, which then results in somebody being kidnapped, tortured, and killed. And meanwhile, the person that they were actually going after, his only real crime, it seems, is conducting unauthorized repairs. And so to me, this sort of encapsulates all the bit debate we're having now. And it was at the very, very early end of the spectrum. Similarly, I mean, I think look at things like, say, like even like Ender's Game, where the types of computing that he's using to troll other members of his school. There's various kinds of cyberbullying going on in that. There is manipulation of online forums and blogs through anonymous entities. I mean, that's the sort of thing that really strikes it with me. It's hard for me to go back further than that because everything I encountered then was kind of like, you know, the social implications were forced upon me as opposed to organically my imagination taking the story and saying, and then making that jump, you know myself. Does that make sense?
Yes.
I'm just kind of rambled on there, I feel like.
That's great. Colin, what about you?
For me, it really comes down to kind of the two poles of my childhood, which I was lucky enough to read outside of school, which would kind of be Lord of the Rings and Dune, I'd really have to say. You know, both are kind of dealing with the economics of scarcity in a very real way. But on the one hand, we have this story about, you know, a monolithic evil that is kind of consuming everything and crushing individuality in Lord of the Rings. Whereas with Dune, you know, we're already within the system. We already live under the yoke of the Imperial Empire. And it's through the spice melange that, you know, we kind of see that the power that a monopoly can wield. Of course, you know, as a kid, you're reading this stuff and you're like, oh, man. Ben Gesserit and the Weirding Way and spaceships and navigators, and you get really lost in the fantastic science fiction of it all. But at its core, it really is a story about monopolies and what it means when you have what everyone else wants. And I think that really taught me an important lesson as a young man, you know, about always watching out for the person who has everything and really looking out for the person who says, you know, I'm in charge, or I have what you need. You know, it's the same kind of reason that I buck against Apple or a Microsoft from back in the day. There's a reason that we're afraid of monopolies. And as a young man, I kind of got that through these fantastic pieces of science fiction in a way that I would never have picked up from a newspaper.
Very cool. So
I just have to say, Colin, I'm delighted. I've never heard One Ring to Rule Them All cited as an example of scarcity.
Well, I, you know, my brain immediately went to, you know, Taco Bell. So it's like, you know, the first one was Taco Bell growing, and the second one is Taco Bell is in charge of everything. And then I went to Demolition Man.
Oh my God, I was literally just about to start talking about the franchise. I love you. Demolition Man is actually fairly quality social science fiction insofar as it is basically looking at what happens when we go full censor, when we go to a point at which we don't even recall the concept of murder, that we don't even recall the concept of other food other than Taco Bell.
Right. Now
we
all don't, restaurants are Taco Bell.
Right. We don't recall the concept of a president that isn't a celebrity, President Schwarzenegger, you know? Like we are looking at, like, that movie is looking at where we're going and saying, if we just let ourselves fall completely into the concept of comfort, it is amazing how quickly we will lose just the basic gross, you know, slimy stuff that makes us human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to jump back in. This is a day for EFF again, but I did want to jump back to this Lord of the Rings thing. And I think Lord of the Rings is a great example of not only where it's shaping public opinion, but it actually shapes how our future is becoming a surveillance state. Listeners may not know, but I'm sure all of you guys do, that one of the major corporations that works on data mining, works on predictive policing, builds database services for the intelligence agencies is called Palantir. And they directly take their name from the all-seeing eye of Sauron.
And people never learn. And they just never learn.
You know,
they took that, and it's kind of this self-fulfilling prophecy for them. I mean, I don't know that when they accepted, when they used that title, that they were setting out to be evil, but
you know, but it should be noted that the Palantirs are not inherently evil.
No, they're not. It's just how they're used. So, Jeremy, you know, why don't you speak up here? What would Nate do?
What would Nate do? Burn it all to the ground.
And by the way, I haven't yet started my new corporation, which I'm going to call Skynet. Go ahead, Jeremy.
There you go. I think, well, you know, look, for me with a strong television background, I think one of the
Max Headroom.
Max Headroom is interesting, but not as interesting as Babylon 5.
Oh, I love Babylon 5 too.
Sweet. Yes. Yep.
My wife had never seen Babylon 5.
The core is mother. The core is father.
We could spend the rest of the hour just citing examples out of that show.
No.
Uh-huh. My wife had never seen it, and so in the around 2004 or 2005, I decided to show it to her, and so we started a rewatch of it, and I hadn't seen it since the show had originally aired. And it aired during the Clinton administration, when pre-internet, or at least early internet, before a lot of the things, certainly pre-war on terror and all that, before a lot of the things that have come to define this century were in place. And, as the show is depicting this sort of slow fascist takeover of Earth, of the U.S. proxy. And I remember, reading on forums and whatnot, so many people saying, this is all Nazi allegory stuff, but it feels dated, like nobody's going to fall for that again. It couldn't happen anymore. Joe Straczynski, the creator and writer of the show, basically said, that's what everyone says. It can't happen here. And in, 1995, that was, going back and rewatching that show in 2005, it was eerie. I mean, it was just creepy how much of these things that had at the time been, references to the past, not exclusively World War II era stuff, but certainly heavily influenced by that. And it was creepy how much it felt like that show was talking about 2005. It is
actually really interesting to think about President Clark not being influenced by President Bush. How fundamentally similar in many ways their campaigns are, their methodology is, their military methodology. I hadn't really thought about that, because I guess I tend to think of Babylon 5 as this kind of like fixed point in time. Like, it just kind of comments on everything. But you're right. It's shocking.
Like I said, it was eerie. If I had never seen the show and you told me it had been, I mean, my wife had trouble. Like, she said, this is 10 years old, really? So that's, that to me is one of the standouts of that.
And all the stuff you're talking about is there. And it's, you're right. If you think about it in that context, it is horribly, horribly creepy.
Yeah.
Yeah. We just need to take away some of your rights for a little while to protect you.
Yeah.
It'll be okay.
Yeah. There's this outside threat, but it's all going to be okay. Watch your neighbors, right? Keep an eye on everybody, because you never quite know who's been influenced by an alien. And some of it simmered down a little bit, but in 2005, or I don't know if it's simmered down or if we're just inured to it, but in 2005, it was terrifying.
Sure. Well, and it's plus you got to give him credit for naming a character Alfred Bester.
Sure. Well, and that's one of the things, when you read what Straczynski's written about the show, it is very heavily influenced by, some of the great sci-fi writers of the past, by Bester, and, Harlan Ellison's was a full-time consultant on it, and occasional cameo appearance. So it more than just about any other sci-fi television, it draws on that. On that body of work in a very strong way.
All right, so that leaves us with Jack.
I'm really happy that you brought up Max Headroom. I think it's probably the best thing that's ever been on television. Television gets away somehow with not critiquing itself very much, or ever, except in these really sort of sober NPR-esque tones, and certainly television doesn't usually allow itself to be satirized, and Headroom did that, and also just the main character being this journalist who goes out and directly points a camera at things, and prefigures both a lot of the stuff that was, well, it reflects a lot of the stuff that was going on in the cyberpunk genre at the time, but then it prefigures what, you know, Warren Ellis was doing in Transmetropolitan.
Oh man, it's got glad this you very Transmetropolitan.
It's got this very punk ethos to it. At the same time, it's sort of like a lot of cyberpunk stuff at the time. It wasn't really commenting on the internet. It has nothing to do with where we are now. It was a comment on television culture and what it had wrought with America. And it was absolutely brilliant in that respect.
And the sad thing is, when you mention Max Headroom, most people think of the MTV interview show. And that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the TV show. Matt Feuer was in it, and he was, just like you said, he was the reporter. He was out there. You know, he had his editor, and it was always like a battle to get it, you know, the truth told. They were trying to tell the truth and show the real story and all that kind of stuff. So completely different show.
Though to jump on the Transmet bandwagon for half a second, I think there's something really interesting there, because that is that's a project that is happening just as the internet is becoming what it is. And Warren Ellis is was very forward thinking insofar as he was kind of constantly running places like The Engine, these sort of chat rooms and discussion forums and communities that he was building very early on the internet in order to essentially crowdsource exactly this kind of thing, crowdsource storytelling, crowdsource the truth, crowdsource on the ground journalism. And he was mostly just doing it through like his punk rock ethos. But, you know, as a kid reading Transmet, that was showing me how I sort of had a choice as a young person. I could either accept the truth as it was coming to me through my television and through the smiling people on the other side of this authority box, or I could look to this other thing that didn't really have a ton of authority. It was pretty messy and pretty impenetrable. But if I dug into it and if I really looked at it critically and I chose to push back into it, I might find a truth that was a lot deeper. And so to sort of continue my little theme of the internet is the answer to everything, I think Transmet very much taught me that the internet could be a solution to many things. And you know, looking at that book, it's been very formative, not just on, I would say, like Colin and I's work, but just my life.
Jack, did you have more that you wanted to add?
I thought it was really interesting that, I don't want to give too many column inches to OSC, but I thought it was really interesting that somebody brought up Ender's Game in a discussion about social sci-fi, because we tend to think of social sci-fi as being this kind of liberal or progressive informed thing that came about in the 1970s. You know, you have Le Guin getting in on it at a time when, you know, when the women's lib movement was kind of at its apex. And, we tend not to look at the portrayal of social stuff that the more right-wing members of the sci-fi community have put out there. And Ender's Game is fascinating because it's got these little things in it that stick out. You know, Card's attitude on the government's population control policies. Minor things like that. And, you know, so I think as much as anything else, there's this weird continuum between works like Le Guin's, which are, you know, incredibly important and take pride of place when we talk about social sci-fi, and the right wing end of the spectrum, which sort of like tapers off into military sci-fi, which, you know, we're not here to talk about military sci-fi, but it's got a social edge to it. And that's interesting when you've got on one hand progressive stuff like Le Guin's and on the other stuff that's borderline fascist. Not that I'm calling OSC a fascist. He's something else.
No, but I think the way this plays out in the current debate over things like surveillance and you know, technology, I think that you see that the far left and the far right are basically on the same page on most things. I think it's that might just be that these issues are important to people who care about things. If you don't care about things, then you don't care about this. But if you do care about your ability to protest, your ability to do anything, then these issues matter. They're kind of not wholly political, because it's not a partisan thing. You know, you care about your privacy, whether you're a, you know, pro-life activist or a tree-hugging Greenpeacer.
The interesting thing about OSC is people have glommed, like, my favorite portrayal of Ender's Game is like, this is the book that people read in high school and then they decide they want to take over the world. And in homage to books like that, there's one other early social sci-fi writer, early-ish, that bears mentioning, and I don't think it's read a lot, which is F. Paul Wilson has this book called An Enemy of the State that's like Ender's Game. It almost reads like an instruction manual for, you know, this is how you, in this case, go about overthrowing an oppressive regime. And whether or not you agree with the theories in it, the ambition of the author to just say, all right, here's how I could plausibly overturn a government for social benefit is just fascinating to read. The process of imagining your way through running a revolution is, well, it seems to have, you know, some historical consequences, given that so many of the revolutionary leaders of the last century were, you know, educators or intellectuals of some sort.
Well, and I'll throw it out there that one of the reasons that I have the three rules of podcasting that I always talk about is because there are people who can't, who once they learn your political or religious views, they filter everything that you write through that lens from that point on.
And that's actually, I think, fairly common. We've had a significant number of outbursts recently. I mean, I spent all of last year dealing with that from one side or the other with the issues going on in SF. But I really, actually, Jack made a perfect point in that social science fiction is not always good. I mean, one of the most pertinent examples of social science fiction probably is Ayn Rand. You know, that's when you talk about social science fiction, you can't leave that out. And there are a significant number. Huh?
I said, sure we could.
Well, and if you look at the interviews with her, that she just basically said, I grew up in Russia. I see the things that happened in Russia happening in America, and I wrote this book.
Yeah. But, you know, social science fiction can sometimes be taken literally where it is meant to be a warning or as a how-to when it should be a how-not-to. And I think that that's one of the big problems with writing to a certain point is if you don't have a readership that's not that it's not intelligent enough, but that it's not self-critical enough, you can run into some serious issues there. Thank you, Patrick. The Soviet bloc, social science fiction has been a huge, huge movement over there, although it hasn't made it really to the U.S. much. It's been a big thing in China. Ken Liu has been translating a ton of wonderful stories from Chinese SF authors, too. So it's one of those things that you see in a lot of countries that are having significant issues. So from that standpoint, I think it's interesting that we're starting to see a lot more American authors dealing with social SF. And so I want to talk about how maybe we're starting to call out some of the issues in our own country and say, hey, you know, this is the kind of stuff that's starting to happen. We need to expose this and we need to deal with this before it gets worse. So the next question would be, you know, who are some of the authors that, besides the people on this podcast, that are dealing with these issues? And just to get people, give people some ideas, again, Ken Liu, Tobias Bacall, Gabriel Garcia Marquez was fantastic, although not quite so modern. Nnedi Okorafor, those are some of the kind of authors I'm talking about here.
And hold on, let's start. I think let's start with Jack.
I was going to say, if there's a science fiction version of Pussy Riot, I want to read their work.
That's amazing.
As far as people who've been writing recently, there's a book that's actually not terribly recent. It's from the I believe it's from the 90s by an author named David Eli called A Journal of the Flood Year. And it is this very stark little dystopia that he comes up with that deals in broad strokes with things like global warming, people becoming more sort of isolated and disconnected from each other, due to the social circumstances that they find themselves in, that sort of thing. And it's a tight little book, and I haven't seen anything else by the guy. Another thing that's one that's come out recently that I really enjoyed was a book called Seed by a guy named Siegler, Robert Siegler, I believe, who does this incredible portrayal of a United States that has just fallen apart under global warming. Massive swaths of land have become desertified, and people are just kind of living as nomadic farmers with a dystopian version of Monsanto writ large, with way better technology, basically ruling over everyone and deciding life and death. And it's another really just stark, tight little book that that I think is kind of among the best of the things that I've read in the social sphere recently.
Very cool. Jeremy.
I've actually just been reading Bruce Sterling's Holy Fire, which is a Methuselah dystopia story where...
Man, I love that book. Love that book.
You know, in which it's that one's tackling one. It's not really necessary. It's not a flash button issue right now, but I have the sneaking suspicion in the next 50 years, it's going to start to become more and more of an issue, which is dealing with lifespan extension. And as, you know, people are living longer and longer, especially affluent people are living longer and longer, what does that end up doing to society? And there's some really interesting stuff in that one. You know,
we
that's
end up
not,
with Elysium.
It's more like Super Sweden.
Well, there's lots of different ways that goes depending on your personal vision of it. But I read a really interesting article a few years back that was in like a Discover magazine about two scientists. These two guys around the turn of the century made a bet as to whether or not a child born in the year 2000 would live to be 150. You know, they're both longevity experts. One of them said yes, the other one said no. My favorite part of the story is they both put like $1,000 into a bank account, which is going to sit there until 2150, at which point that money plus 150 years worth of interest will be dispersed to the descendants of whoever wins the bet. you know, I think that's going to have a huge, strange, and probably not very pleasant effect on society. And that, you know, I'm interested in things that are exploring that. We'll say in terms of TV right now, Person of Interest, if, yes. You know, if you have any interest in the surveillance state and you're not watching Person of Interest, you're not, you know, watching one of the great sci-fi explorations of that happening before your eyes.
Well, and the cool thing about Person of Interest is it's sneaky sci-fi.
Yes. Yeah, as it gets more and more into AI and all that sort of thing. You know, which I don't think is where anybody thought the show was going when it premiered, but, you know, when the news about Prism broke, you know, and
I love how smug the fandom was when that happened. So many people were just like, told you.
Well, yep. So I have actually sitting on my wall, the key cards from 2013, San Diego Comic-Con, the hotel key cards, which Person of Interest sponsored. And on the back of it, it says wiretaps, drones, surveillance records, hijacked machines, and down the center it says "told ya," which is the exact thing that we were telling people at EFF when they were calling after the Prism, you know, stuff exploded. Yep. We were like, "Well, we've been telling you this for years and years now." And then if you actually went and saw the Person of Interest premiere at San Diego in 2013, they had this video that, you know, mixed in James Clapper lying to Senator Wyden. It had Edward Snowden. It had President Obama claiming that metadata wasn't a big deal. And these were the same clips that we kept going back to as well. It was really fascinating. But another interesting thing is that I actually had the chance to interview the cast and writers of it, both at 2013 Comic-Con, but also at 2014. And the level of knowledge that even the cast members had 2013-2014 was huge. I mean, they had really thought about this a lot more and the implications of this show that they're on within the context of events. I had this feeling that when they came into it, in 2011, 2012, this was just some sort of high-tech thriller. But now, between 2013, 2014, they've really realized that it has, you know, a serious role to play in the social debate over surveillance in our country.
Thank you, Dave. Yeah. And actually, Dave, I was going to go to you next.
Oh, sure. You're going to have to remind me what the question is again, because you keep coming back to me fairly mid to late in it.
Jane, you want to remind him of the question?
Current authors.
Yes.
There you go.
Sorry. Okay. So right off the bat, Ramez Nam is at the top of my list with Flux and Nexus. And these are books that deal with, you know, the societal implications, the cultural implications, but also the law enforcement implications of technology that links people's minds together. I also feel like maybe this is somewhat of a newer classic, but I think Werner Vinge's Rainbow's End is perhaps one of the most realistic, or at least, I mean, realistic in quotation marks, portrayals of how things might look in another 10 years or so in terms of what we do to libraries, in terms of what technology is going to look like when you can't actually tinker with it yourself, as well as when life expectancies start to grow and there's this gap between people who understand and people who have to catch up. And another sort of one that maybe it's a little bit off the radar is a book by Leonard Richardson out of Texas called Constellation Games. Have any of you guys read that?
No.
No. So this is an interesting book that looks at what video games from other planets would look like. and it's this story told from the point of view of a video games reviewer at his blog, and this collection of aliens on this ship who are – there's a delegation of aliens come to Earth, and he sends them an email, you know, saying, hey, I would love to check out your video games. And so he's just this book of reviews of alien video games, but it also ends up dealing with you know, issues of secrecy and secret police, but also of intellectual property. There's, you know, a phone unlocking plays a major role in it. It's a really good thing. And then you brought up Cory Doctorow at the beginning, and when I'm talking to my parents or people who don't really understand what EFF does, and I need to give them a good sort of step in the door, I push little brother at them. I say, this is a book that is going to explain where we are, why we do what we do, and what the dangers are in the future.
Very cool. And Jeremy, I apologize. Were you done with your thought? Hello, Jeremy.
I think we lost Jeremy.
We may have lost Jeremy. So we're going to go to Colin.
Well, I mean, mostly I've just been listening to this and jotting down all these books because they sound absolutely amazing.
That's typically what happens, yes.
Yeah, I feel like there's just a wealth of stuff kind of washing over me. The book I actually just finished was Mike Carey's The Girl with All the Gifts, which is, you know, kind of more of a post-apocalyptic zombie story, but with the interesting focus on looking on what happens next, what happens when humanity itself has fallen. And what the next phase of humanity, how humanity can survive kind of in an evolved state and within our own failures.
Well, I would like to welcome my robot overlords.
Right, exactly. Sometimes you just have to accept that humanity is doomed, which I found, frankly, kind of refreshing. But speaking domestically, and I know we're not supposed to talk about any of the people on this panel, but, you know, Jack and I are moving into the second volume of Hacktivist right now, which we like to consider the entire book to be science fiction of 5 minutes from now. It's the future. It's the story about what could happen just around the corner. And with our second volume specifically, we're looking very closely at domestic issues and kind of what's going on in our own backyards. So obviously no one's read it yet, but this is stuff that's all very near and dear to our hearts. So every book that everyone's mentioned, we're going to want to dive into and make sure that it informs our choices.
Very cool. And speaking of Jackson.
Hey, here I am. So I want to go back a couple of years back to an author that pretty much I'm sure we've all heard of and we've probably all read this book. It's not like it was really one that fell under the radar, but I think it probably doesn't get its due as a social sci-fi book just because it's so wonky in some ways, which was Neal Stephenson's Anathem. Which I it was kind of a fascinating work from him because it rather than dealing really directly with some social issues, which I think he's done in the past very directly in things like Diamond Age and obviously to some degree in Snow Crash, though those books are fairly pulpy or say Cryptonomicon, which deals, I think, very, very, very directly with our relationship with cryptography and our relationship with secrets and our relationship with all of that. Anathem is kind of fantastic because rather than going directly at the problem, he kind of goes around it and looks at our relationship with knowledge in general. Again, looking at Fahrenheit 451 and self-policing of knowledge, one of the really cool things about Anathem is that it looks at the idea of it takes place in a world where legitimately no one can do math. That the people who do math, the people that do science, the people that handle knowledge live in sequestered, secluded areas, essentially monasteries known as Maths, and that all the people there that I think they call themselves Fras that live in these Maths are the ones who are allowed this knowledge, and they are not allowed access to the rest of the world. And that's not for the good of the rest of the world. It's not that the world has shut them up in these Maths and won't let them leave. It's that they have shut themselves up in these Maths and do not want to leave, because to leave is to essentially allow the outside world, which they no longer trust with their sort of purity of knowledge, to affect their knowledge. And it shows kind of the opposite side of this angle, where we say, okay, well, we need to make sure that we don't self-police to the degree that we eliminate knowledge. We also have to make sure that as we establish ourselves and create more knowledge and create more science and create the future, that we don't sequester our smartest and our brightest and our future away from the population. I think there's this wear and tear that we're starting to see in our everyday lives between people that are educated and people that are not. And Anathem essentially says, all right, well, if we take that all the way towards the place where we as sort of educated individuals feel safe because we are only surrounded by those who are educated, what we do is we let the rest of the world rot. And the rest of the world will very well go on and go on in its own way, but it will be worse for the wear for us not being there, and we will be worse for wear for not engaging with their humanity. I thought it was a really beautiful book about looking at elitism, about looking at the sort of the more extreme tendencies of leftist ideas as well. Which, as you rightly pointed out, is not necessarily something that you see a lot in social sci-fi, which tends to lean left. And I think, obviously there have been some there's definitely been some backlash in Hacktivists that we've leaned very left. And in the first book, we do. And I think you'll see that as we move forward, that's, I think, kind of what Colin's indicating. We're really looking to try and tackle this from a few more angles because there's not just one story to be told here. We've got to we have a whole population and everybody's got stories, regardless of what sort of side ideologically they land on. So I really liked Anathem for that. And then as we're talking about film, I'd be bummed if I didn't mention Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which I thought was legitimately excellent social science fiction, dealing with racism and dealing with our tendency to distrust the other and dealing with our tendencies towards war really managed to actually pull something together out of a massive, massive Hollywood blockbuster, which I can tell you, just as somebody who's on the ground of that stuff a lot, as we said, not a lot of stuff getting made. That's the kind of thing that is very, very difficult to get through the Hollywood system. So the fact that Matt Reeves was able to do that with that project is, I think, pretty Herculean and really should be respected. So regardless of whether or not you saw Rise, I would advise everyone, if they can, to go see Dawn. It's quite a movie.
Well, I can't believe that no one has mentioned, Enemy Mine.
Oh, absolutely.
But
would you call Enemy Mine a modern novel? I mean, certainly Enemy Mine was probably more something for that we could have dropped it on that last question, but it's in a lot of ways probably the basis of a lot of social science fiction when it comes to, just that very concept that is now iterates in all fiction of, hey, let's take two people from opposite sides of a conflict and let's throw them together and really make them cohabitate, because it's amazing what happens when two people from opposite sides of a thing actually start to look at each other as people.
Shotgun.
Well, and also what happens when your best friend turns out to be a pregnant woman.
Well, here's the thing. I have learned that you're not allowed to ask. You're not allowed to ask.
Right. You have to wait. It's rude. It's rude. Wait.
So, James, we are running out of time. You have probably enough time for one more question.
Okay, and briefly before we go into that, I actually am going to be very crass and plug one of the stories from War Stories by Mark Jacobson.
War Stories. Would that be the anthology that you edited?
It would. Huh. So,
what's the name of that anthology again?
War Stories.
Oh, War Stories.
I heard Rigor Mortis. Go ahead.
Yeah, you're going to pay for that one. So when we went through the slush originally, it was one of the stories that just did not, at first look, seem to fit the theme of the anthology. Basically what it is it's the story of a woman in Syria in the near future. And that future is ruled by American troops that have brought absolute peace to the area by use of personal surveillance drones for every single person. And those drones have the ability to essentially make judgment calls and kill anyone that they find to be a threat. Of course, things get subverted as usual. You know, you have total power, something's going to start going wrong. And through a series of tragedies, she decides to go back to her activism days that started in the Arab Spring and start a peaceful resistance. And the story was just, it was one of those that you read it and you kind of went, is this really as powerful as I think it is? And then you go back and go, no, actually, that's terrifyingly possible. So that story was just really one of the ones that sort of made me realize how much good stuff is coming out right now that is possibly not getting seen because it's still in the short story form, which not as many people know about. But,
well, as John Klima said, you know, short fiction is dead. Long live short fiction.
So what I want to talk about before we finish up is the power of visual media to do, you know, the sneaky things like Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, Eclipse Phase and the RPGs, comic books with hacktivist. What does the visual element or the role-playing element bring to it that allows people to immerse themselves and have kind of a better handle on it than just reading a straight text story sometimes will do?
And this time we're going to start with Jeremy because I think he's back now. Jeremy?
Yes.
So why don't you go for it?
Well, you know, so what's interesting about that particularly is the stuff that I've done in games. You know, in the world of serious games, one of the things that we like to say is that all games are educational games. All games are teaching games. Generally, all the game teaches you is the rules of the game. But if you make those rules align with real-world learning objectives, then through the process of learning the rules and learning how to play the game, you're actually imparting greater knowledge or helping someone to learn something, you know, that actually has real-world application. You know, when we did the redistricting game, we more or less, we just took the straight-up rules for redistricting, and we gamified them. And so you play it, and you have a very experiential learning experience of, you know, holy crap, it's that easy? Because it pretty much is.
Hey, I only want the people who are going to vote for me to be in my district.
That is exactly what ends up happening. And even if you come into it, I mean, we allowed you to play as a member of either party in that game. And, you know, I had people who came in saying gerrymandering is wrong. And by the end of the game, they're like, oh, God, look what I've done. I'm a terrible person. But I couldn't stop. You know, there's one other quick example I'll share. I don't have sources to fully cite this. So it may well be apocryphal, but it's a good enough story that I'll perpetuate it anyway. The original version of Monopoly, I believe, was published, at least according to this story I'd heard, was published like in the early 30s. And the original intent was to demonstrate how capitalist landlords are bad for the people. And so it was really about the reason you're paying rent constantly. It's not that you're supposed to be making money. It's that you're supposed to be giving money out. And so the game was originally about basically the ruination of individuals by the overly dominant capitalist society. Somebody took this game and just made the slight tweak of you are the dominant capitalist society. And then it became the game of crushing your opponents into dust beneath your boot while you make all the monies, whatever it takes. Again, there's an experiential element to that that teaches a lesson, whether it's the lesson you want to teach or not. That's another question. That doesn't really address the visual elements of it, but I think, you know.
It addresses the role playing in a way.
Certainly. Experiences. Can I say that? Can I get away with that?
We'll allow it this once. You know.
And we all love to find the rules for that game, for like a tweak on Monopoly to play as the crushed, as the poor SOB is crushed under the boot.
Yeah,
that'd be a game to get your friends together with.
And then whether or not it was a good idea to do that is one thing, but as a persuasive game, you know, I think that it probably made a pretty good point. You know, so that is an elegant statement, what I just said there.
Well, and your point about games having things to teach us is a good one. I mean, look at what Angry Birds taught, you know, people about security on their phones.
Well, but you could just as easily imagine a phone hack game, right? That's really about, hey, here's how easy it is to have your phone hacked, because you know, as you play as a hacker breaking into defenseless people, whatever, you could easily envision the existence of a game like that to attempt to prove a point.
I would be surprised if something like that is in development, actually.
Oh, this is Dave. Can I go next so I don't forget the question,
Dave,
this time?
Yes, yes.
Well, playing off that point, there is a game out now called Watch Dogs, which is kind of exactly that. I actually bought a PlayStation 4 just so I could play this game for, quote, research purposes at my day job. But this is a video game that you run around Chicago and you're able to use facial recognition to gather information on people and tap into this government database to learn things about whether they have money in their bank or they have herpes or they've been in jail. And you can hack their phones and you can hack their cameras in their apartments. And that is how you progress in this video game. So I definitely think that using that element – I mean, it's always difficult to – turn computers into a visual medium because, you know, I saw read an interview with a photographer once who was complaining that cell phones are making the world less visual because everybody's just on their cell phones and that you can't tell the difference between somebody who's reading a book on their cell phone to somebody who's playing a video game or somebody who's, you know, having a sexual encounter on their phone. It all looks the same on the outside world. I think if you saw that. It was a pretty terrible movie, but the movie adaptation of the Julian Assange story that came out last year with Benedict Cumberbatch, they were trying to illustrate this computer world by having them on beaches and in big, you know, on their computers and beaches or on their computer in a giant empty office. And that was kind of effective to a certain extent. But, you know, one of my favorite ways that you know, this is probably not wholly relevant, but one of my – the scene that came to mind for me for how visual medium can express complex concepts very quickly is in the movie Children of Men, there's this beautiful – I think it must be like an 8-second shot. It's when you're first meeting this character played by Michael Caine, who's a retired political cartoonist living under this oppressive British regime. And it's just a pan across this house where you see basically within 10 seconds how Britain went from a country of freedom to a country of oppression based on just bumper stickers, headlines, political cartoons. It just does all of this history really quickly. And I always found that was a very effective way to describe the erosion of civil liberties through technological events.
And, you know, just in case Watch Dogs really felt like too grounded hacking, once you get up to a point, you can use your cell phone to take all manner of technology and turn it into a giant spider drone that you can just fly around, or you can walk around Chicago and
your spider cars. Well, the spider tank is actually technically a quote digital trip because they
all right,
because they didn't want to put LSD trips into the game, so you have a digital trip. where you are a spider tank. But you know,
I'm pretty sure the NSA is working on spider tank right now, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, totally. DARPA funded project for sure.
I think DARPA already has one of those.
Yeah. We've got Cheetah, who can run faster than a cheetah, and we've got Pet Man that looks like a human, and you've got Big Dog that can't fall down. It's pretty incredible. I'm sure spider tanks buried in there somewhere.
One of the interesting things about Watch Dogs is the use of surveillance cameras, and that you're actually, you know, where you would have in a game where you need to work your way through a maze, you know, in this, you know, third, you know, it will, you know, in a Wolfenstein kind of environment. Instead, you're using surveillance cameras to go through mazes. You're seeing one surveillance camera and jumping to the next surveillance camera and jumping to the next surveillance camera, or, you know, figuring out little puzzles so you can peek on somebody, you know, having some sort of, strange encounter in their bedrooms. I mean, that's a very interesting way to illustrate the type of world we live in by, I mean, you know, you don't want people to go and actually hack, you know, like actually hack people's phones, but giving them this sort of environment where they can do that, and then they're faced with this moral quandary about whether they feel good or bad about spying on somebody in a game, and we, which they have never even gained anything of use from doing so.
That does kind of bring back the memory of that experiment that was run about whether or not you would actually shock someone, you know, and cause them pain.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. There's a game I wanted to bring up, if you don't mind, just because
I was going to call on you next, so go ahead.
Fantastic. It goes right alongside this. So Watch Dogs is a big AAA title. That's, you know, a large game company put, you know, hundreds of thousands of man hours into this. There's another game that came out this year. It's a one man to put this whole thing together. And I'm trying to remember his name so I make sure that he gets the credit he deserves as I'm talking about this. Lucas Pope. And the game is called Papers, Please. And the amazing thing.
I was going to bring this up too.
Haha. Sorry, dude.
It's okay.
Swept. The thing about Papers, Please is that Papers, Please essentially is like it looks like kind of a low res, like 16-bit or 8-bit game, but the thought behind it is just beautifully done. The idea is basically you take on the position of a Soviet border guard in a fictional Soviet country surrounded by other fictional Soviet countries. But essentially you're in a despotic state that's pretending to be – or not to pretending to be, but maybe at one point was a proletariat-run state but has since become something kind of different over time. And you are one of the many proletariat, and you have the great, honorable, glorious job of sitting at this, you know, this checkpoint that you can barely pronounce, and taking in individuals. And every round of the game is a day of you sitting there at this border checkpoint as one by one people come in, and they all have different faces, they all have different backgrounds, they all have different names, and they present you with their papers. And every day you're going to be getting new options in terms of what the government needs in terms of papers for people to get into this country. But those people, they can tell you their story. They'll walk in and they'll say, look, I'm being chased, I need to get through this checkpoint, or, you know, there is a band of political I am a political refugee. There are a band of military men who are going to come after me, are going to kill me. You have to let me through. But they don't have the papers. And it's up to you for each one of these people to stamp their passport or not. And the trick is, if you don't stamp the passports, or you do stamp the passports, right? If you only let in the people that you should be letting in, you will make a good amount of money. You'll be able to feed your family because your family needs to be fed. You'll be able to get a better house, which is great for you because occasionally another family member of yours will die and leave you their children. You will...
In fact,
happens all over the place in impoverished countries when families that are far too large cannot sustain themselves by way of food. And you end up with these really like these tight-knit families where many of them may have come, you know, maybe living with parents that aren't their own. And this game puts you in the position of somebody who needs to feed their family, who needs to keep themselves together, but at the same time is doing some pretty like cold-hearted stuff in order to do this. However, if you don't want to do the cold-hearted stuff, you don't have to. You can do the other thing, and you won't be paid as much, and you'll get docked. And if they figure out that you're doing it, you know, enough, and you don't hide it well enough, the government will show up and they will kill you. There are revolutionaries who you can get recruited by. It's an amazing social study that operates sort of as long as you want it to operate. I think it's like a 25 level thing until you finally win. And the only good ending is one that you do exactly what the government says the entire time, and eventually you get moved to another checkpoint.
I walked in once, and Jack had been playing for about an hour. He was covered in a cold sweat. He was furiously clicking. I was like, "Bro, what's wrong?" He was like, "I have to save them, Colin. I have to save them." It's this amazingly immersive game.
Well, it's insanely affecting.
And this is to jump in on that thought. You know, the conventional wisdom that you always hear when you're talking about visual media is show, don't tell, right? With games, it's do, don't show.
Yes.
And that's what makes them such an effective, persuasive tool.
Though each of those people has a face. And I think that's kind of what I mean about the visuality of it all. You are looking at a person, and you're not looking at a bunch of pixels. You're looking at an old woman, or you're looking at a child. A hacktivist or any comic that's dealing with social issues is aided by being able to put a face on those issues, being able to say, this is a person who's on the ground, who's really dealing with this, and you're going to deal with them not as a social construct or as a science fiction idea, but as a person. And that is something that even when you apply it to a machine, like you look at what happened to Her, and which I think is also a pretty good example of a kind of social sci-fi, that you end up seeing empathy where you may not have thought you would experience empathy. And I think empathy is probably the biggest barrier to change in a lot of ways, because once you empathize with the situation, it becomes much easier to see yourself in it and trying to change it.
Colin, what do you want to add?
I'll be real fast. I just have two things I want to quickly ping on. The first is a little game by our overlords at Google called Ingress. And I don't know if you guys know about Ingress, but it's the easiest way to lose your life. It's essentially the gamification of data mining. Ingress is a game that happens in real time in the world around you that you play on your phone. It utilizes your GPS location, your contacts, your photos, and any other data that you have on your phone, which you have given to Google willingly, to create a game-based environment that is essentially a game of capture the flag that you are playing with every other Ingress user on the entire planet. It takes the entire concept of privacy and turns it into an action game, a strategy game that dehumanizes everyone around you, and in turn forces you into conflict. It's one of the most fascinating social experiments that I've seen in the last decade.
And meanwhile, Google's taking all that data.
Yep.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
No. Not Google.
We love Google.
Yeah.
Don't be evil.
Pulling this back around, we had a thing with Hacktivist. There's nothing more boring than watching two people typing on a computer. So what we try to achieve, you set up the social context, you send up addressing, and then skip the business and show the resolution. Because it's what happens that is going to really draw people in. It's the ramifications that are going to draw people in, and we can read about it, and we can think about it conceptually, but being able to add that visual element, as Jackson said, putting a face on it, is really going to be what gets people out of their chairs, gets boots on the ground, and gets people really engaged. So bringing that visual element, I think, is a really important part of any social sci-fi, especially in our visual age, when we have such short attention spans, and we really do need to see all those bright, shiny, blinky colors.
Jack?
Well, I've had a little bit different experience with this because I make a pen and paper role-playing game. And the thing that I've found interesting is that the social issues that are at work in the world that we've created, they really start to occupy people at kind of a different level of engagement than you get in a computer game. Because, I can have you be a man one day and then download you into a young woman the other day and into a, neuter octopus the next day. So we have ubiquitous micromanufacturing. Everybody uses social networks for money. death is kind of semi-erased because everyone has backups and there's ubiquitous cloning of bodies. But when players are playing that around a table, you know, they're kind of there to shoot some bug-eyed alien monsters and have fun with their friends. What happens, though, is I find the most fascinating discussions about the deep, you know, philosophical discussions that people get very invested in, to the point where we've had to, you know, be careful about moderation in our forums as they start to engage with the backstory of the world. And I, you know, I have people asking questions like, if everybody's a clone in this world, oh my God, where do babies come from? Well, that's not important when you're writing this game, but people get invested in the world and they want to find out. We've been having this incredibly detailed and sometimes feisty discussion that's come up multiple times over the years that we've been doing about this game, about the question of, you know, if your character uploads, you know, and then downloads into a new body, are they the same person or did they just die? Or you have the question of, all right, well, I can get a, you know, I can get an augmentation put into my body that lets me never sleep. Am I going to be like the people in Beggars in Spain by Nancy Kress, where I can just take over the world while everybody else is sleeping? And, you know, these questions then with experienced players, they kind of filter back into play and people start to play with them more. But it's when you've got this body of published work that people are reading and having active community discussions on that you start to see these really amazing moments where people are really scratching their head and saying, wow, like the politics in this game, would they work in real life or are they complete crazy talk? So that's one of the most rewarding things about me for being a game maker is the fiction that you create is something that people are actively encouraged to use as a sandbox with and think about in their lives when they're not playing the game, and it can have some really interesting results.
I would suggest that everybody go and check out a movie. It was made in 1992. It's called Sneakers. I don't know if anybody remembers that, but it's a It wasn't really science fiction, but it kind of sort of is, because it's talking about, you know, the ultimate code breaking and no information being safe anywhere.
By the way, my recollection of the era when that film came out was that everybody knew the FBI and the CIA, but the NSA was not something as many people had heard of. Mm-hmm. And when that's a plot point in the movie, is they drop the NSA and people are like, oh, what?
Yeah, no, Sneakers is kind of a perfect film. It holds up to time.
It does.
It was relevant then. It's relevant now. And it does it in a smart way that makes sense. And it's not – I mean, we keep recommending it to people, and we all often have too many secrets and no more secrets puns show up in our blog posts. So, yeah, no, I definitely agree. That is a very worthwhile film, especially also just because of the cast. Is
I know
awesome.
Dan Aykroyd, Robert Redford, Sidney Poitier, River Phoenix. Yep.
Ben Kingsley,
David Strathairn.
Yes, Ben Kingsley.
Are we just naming actors?
Iron
now?
Man 3. Yeah,
they're all
Brad
in that
Pitt.
No. Kevin Bacon. Ha! I win.
Damn.
I feel like we should have defined the rules for that game before we started. I mean, you know, I think that one of the most important things about social science fiction is that a lot of it now is just fiction. It's not science fiction. It's not about a future that could be. You know, talking about Margaret Atwood would be an excellent example of that. But also I want to mention G. Willow Wilson and her A Leaf the Unseen, which I read last year, and that was just absolutely fantastic. But also Shirley Jackson. Shirley Jackson wrote some amazing stuff that was really, really good. And since she hadn't been mentioned yet, I wanted to make sure we got her in.
Okay, so we are completely out of time, guys. It's been like an hour and a half. We need to wrap this up, so I'm going to give everybody an opportunity to just throw out their final thoughts, and then end it with your website and your social media again. So let's go around. Jame, any final thoughts you want to throw out there before I get to the guys?
That there is a ton of stuff that will frequently benefit from a second reading. Person of Interest is amazing. And War Stories is actually, it has a lot of social science fiction in it that also intersects with the military.
Okay. Dave.
Oh, hey, that was quick. Yeah. Well, I also wanted to plug Anne Leckie's Ancillary Justice, because I don't feel like
yes.
we didn't mention enough female authors in this. And that was – there's actually some sci-fi tech policy reading groups, one here in San Francisco, one here in New York. Both of us have worked through Ancillary Justice as well as a few other books that we've mentioned here, especially Nexus by Nam Ramez. But yeah, so again, I work at EFF. Our website is EFF.org. I always recommend signing up for our mailing list to keep apprised a lot of these issues that were, science fiction 10 minutes ago, but now, are reality today. And as well as just sort of keeping track of what's on the horizon. Follow us on Twitter at EFF. It's pretty simple. And I'm a massive with an extra A. So it's massive, but not massive. It's just massive. Just two beats in the middle there. And yeah, keep an eye out for our short fiction collection. That's also along these issues, and it should be out sometime next year.
When you did the massive thing, I went to Babylon 5 and Zathras. Zathras. Zathras knows. Zathras. Yes, Zathras knows.
Not
Zathras,
the one.
Zathras, it's me.
Not the one.
No, Zathras, never met you. No, I am Zathras. You met Zathras.
Not the one.
Not the one. No, not the one.
No. Not the one.
Jack. Wow. Jack, go.
I just I want to close with a plug for a game called Shock Social Science Fiction that was written a few years back by my friend Joshua A.C. Newman. It's a small press indie RPG that is a storytelling kit for social science fiction, wherein people choose some issues and they choose some technologies or other things that are different about the world that tie to those issues, and then collaboratively create a piece of science fiction around it. He's even got a setting for it that's based on Le Guin's Ecumen cycle of stories. It's a really interesting sandbox for people who are, if you've got four creative people who want to knock around some sci-fi ideas. It's a lot of fun. And again, my own work is found at eclipsephase.com. Thanks for having me.
Very cool. Jeremy.
Yeah, my Twitter handle is fajitas, like the food. As far as last thoughts go,
Totally going to sign up for Cadillac fajitas.
Please do. I'll also.
What?
That's I'll just
what you
add
have to order at freaking. Oh my god! What's the name of this? It's the big chain. I forget the name of them. Chili's.
Oh,
Cadillac fajitas. That's what you order that, and then they actually bring you beans and rice.
Good for them. I guess. I would like to say, pursuant to that, I would like to say, very important people, know the difference between pound fajitas and at fajitas when you're tweeting. Mm. As a final thought, I guess, what I just like to say, look, Leverage is a lighthearted show. Like I said, almost every episode we did was based on real-world research and real-world cases. In almost every episode, we had to tone the real story down because no one would believe it. So the stuff you hear when you're reading social sci-fi or genre, social genre or all of that stuff, it probably never hurts to assume that things are worse than the story is telling you, because, suspension of disbelief works like that. So read these things with a grain of salt and honestly do your research, because, I learn more. Someone will say something, oh, hey, here's an issue. And you go into the research rabbit hole and you learn things that horrify you, and things you can't believe that the entire world doesn't know. So be an informed and a participatory media consumer.
And just so people understand, Leverage was airing on TNT. Fortunately, it's no longer airing.
It is on Netflix.
It is on Netflix.
It's on Hulu, and I believe it's airing on ION.
Sadly, we never did get the leverage Falling Skies crossover we were all hoping for.
No, but if I could shamelessly plug, I did recently have the privilege of working on a show called The Librarians, which is starring Noah Wiley and is produced by a great many of the people who were involved with Leverage. And that will be airing on TNT in December, he said shamelessly. It's Indiana Jones meets Doctor Who.
I like those movies. Those were good movies.
Yeah.
They were entertaining.
That's as close to a Falling Skies Leverage crossover as I think you'll get.
Exactly.
But there you are.
All right.
I should also plug The First Contact Job, which was a Leverage episode in which we convinced a...
Oh, that was hilarious!
a scientist who'd been stealing other people's research that he had made contact with aliens. That's pretty much a Falling Skies Leverage crossover.
Oh, that was amazing. That was a great episode. Speaking of skitters, Colin.
as you all know, I am an alien. On Twitter, I'm at CP Kelly. Online, I'm the Colin Kelly. If there's just one closing thought, I just want to say that if there's any young writers out there or anyone out there kind of pursuing their storytelling craft, don't put science fiction and social science fiction in different boxes. Unless you're actively trying to say something important about now, you're wasting people's time. Everything that you write, everything that draws your passion should be drawn from what's around you and should reflect, you know, what matters to you and what's happening in our world. At least that's my opinion, and I'm sticking to it. Thank you very much, guys.
Jackson.
I'm at Jackson Lansing on Twitter. I'm jacksonlansing.com. Again, like Michigan, but with a Z. To sort of finish things off, I want to just mention that I think it's hilarious that none of us have mentioned Star Trek, which has probably done more bulk social science fiction storytelling than anything in the history of social science fiction, and has included writers from some of the earliest female science fiction writers, like the incredible DC Fontana, all the way up through modern people. Well, I'm sorry, what was that?
Diane Duane.
And of course, Diane Duane, absolutely. I would also love to shout out a great comic that came out that might have run under a lot of people's radar unless they were really into comics that talks about something we haven't really spoken about, which is like sexuality and gender issues, which is a book called Our Love is Real by Sam Humphries. Sam's a friend, to be like super transparent about it, but it was a really incredible book about kind of what it means to love and what it means to judge another person's love. And there are still copies that can be found out there because now it's been published or at least reprinted by Image. And I want to just back up everything Colin said. If you're writing and you're not actually writing about what's going on, I don't know why you're writing.
All righty. Well, thanks to everybody for coming on. James, thanks for wrangling everybody. Anything that you want to say before we let you go?
Nope.
That's it. All right. Well, thanks, everybody. This has been great. I suggest that our listeners go out and check out every single one of these guys. And, of course, that anthology that moved people to tears and possibly made them vomit that James had a hand in. And
what was the name of that anthology again?
War Stories. Yes.
War Stories.
Yes. Yes. And that's it. That's it for this one. We're calling this one done. I will be at Mile High Con, but James won't, so I'm safe. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Hugo Award-winning SF Signal podcast. Your host is Patrick Hester, an author, a blogger, and a functional nerd. His website is www.atfmb.com, which stands for All Things From My Brain. ATFMB is also his Twitter handle and where you can find him on Facebook. Our podcast is available for download every week at sfsignal.com or via iTunes. Look for the links to subscribe in the sidebar at sfsignal.com or search SF Signal in iTunes. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and have them tell their friends and so on and so on. Visit the Hugo Award-winning sfsignal.com for all of your speculative fiction needs. John D. and the SF Signal regulars offer up new content every day, from weekly mind melds featuring your favorite authors, editors, and artists from the SF&F field, to book reviews, original articles and essays, fiction deals, movie reviews, videos, links and roundup posts, and more. Click the RSS button in the sidebar of your browser to ensure you never miss a post. The SF Signal podcast is powered by the Functional Nerds.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Angry robot.
Magic Wooey.
Wah, wah.
Thinking and crap.
And scene.